coming up on Star Stuff. New studies show dark matter doesn't seem to interact with anything, not even itself. NASA's plan to pluck a boulder off an asteroid and put it into orbit around the moon. And nitrogen, a key building block of life, discovered on the red planet Mars. All that and more coming up on Star Stuff.
This is Star Stuff.
A new study of colliding galaxy clusters has concluded that dark matter doesn't seem to interact with anything, not even itself. The findings, reported in the journal Science, mean some existing dark matter models, which give the mysterious substance properties similar to normal matter, will now need to be revised. The study's lead author, Dr. David Harvey from the École Polytechnique in Lucerne, Switzerland, says his research has found that dark matter exists in a ghostly state without interacting with anything, not even itself. Astronomers first noticed dark matter when they realized there wasn't sufficient gravitational attraction to keep stars orbiting as fast as they do around the centers of galaxies. Another, apparently invisible substance, which scientists have called dark matter, dark because they have no idea what it is, must be providing this additional gravity. Scientists estimate dark matter makes up about 85% of all the matter in the universe. The rest, the normal matter, which makes up all the stars, planets, dust, gas clouds, moons, asteroids, comets, houses, trees, dogs, cats, cars and people, the stuff scientists call baryonic matter, makes up just 15% of all the matter in the universe. Scientists had previously only studied a single galaxy cluster collision called the Bullock Cluster to try and understand how dark matter interacts both with itself and with normal matter. Galaxy clusters are huge gravitationally bound collections of galaxies, which form the largest known structures in the universe. These clusters are composed of immense clouds of gas and dust, and they're full of galaxies full of stars. The new research by Harvey and colleagues examined 72 galaxy cluster collisions to see how dark matter is interacting. The authors compiled optical and X-ray images of galaxy cluster collisions using data from the Earth-orbiting Chandra X-ray Observatory and the Hubble Space Telescope. The X-rays are emitted by hot gas, and that allows scientists to pinpoint where the gas clouds are located. The optical data shows the location of the galaxies, both in the clusters and behind them. By looking at background galaxies behind the clusters, astronomers can see how light from those galaxies is being bent by the mass of the foreground cluster. The way this light is being bent provides clues about where the cluster's dark matter is located and how it interacts during collisions. The authors found galaxies pass through each other unimpeded during collisions, with the only influence being gravity. They also found that the gas in each galaxy cluster interacts strongly with the gas in the colliding cluster as they merge. The gas slows down, it gets dragged back, and is separated from its original galaxy. So the question is, what's dark matter doing during these collisions? Harvey says the dark matter in each cluster wasn't slowing down or interacting with the dark matter in the other cluster. It was simply going right through without any interaction at all. It was simply following the galaxies and their stars, or more accurately, the galaxies were following the dark matter. According to Harvey, this is telling science that dark matter doesn't interact the way normal baryonic matter interacts.
A while back in early 2000s, there was a study of the Bullock Cluster, and they constrained this parameter that kind of tells you the probability of two dark matter particles like colliding with each other. So what are the chances that if they come together, they bounce off each other?
This is the Pico band.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's like if you had like two like basketballs and you threw them at them, the probability will be basically how big they are. So mm-hmm. The bigger they are, like the bigger the chance they got. And whereas, you know, for like two protons, it's a bit different because they scatter because they're both positively charged. So they like bounce off each other in that way. So you have different types. But basically, we wanted to, with the Bullock Cluster and other studies, was that these just one estimate and using one colliding galaxy cluster. And the problem is that using just one, it's very dependent on how did the crash work, you know, what happened, what were the initial conditions, how did they hit each other. And basically, what we wanted to do was we wanted to try and build up a statistical sample of many of these to try and make a more robust estimate of this parameter of dark matter.
And so you looked at 72 galactic collisions, which gave you a nice sort of statistical spread there. How do you do the research?
So what we did was we have a big collection of X-ray galaxy clusters. So there's a big sample from the Chandra X-ray Observatory, and there's lots of, and there's my boss supervisor at the time had a big sample he'd like cleaned and smoothed and reduced and made look pretty. So to begin with, I just searched through that big sample of all the Chandra galaxy clusters and looked for where the gas had been all merged and gone a bit messy and all over the place, and that basically showed signs of a galaxy collision. And then taking that data, we then went to the Hubble Space Telescope and we said, is there optical data of this? So we've got the X-ray data that shows that this galaxy cluster has collided. Now, can we see if there is coverage from Hubble? And from the total of about hundreds of clusters in Chandra, we found 30 galaxy clusters that had been imaged by the Hubble Space Telescope.
Hubble lets you see the stars.
So yeah, so Hubble counts for two things. So Hubble, the first thing Hubble, because in the galaxy cluster, you have the X-ray emitting gas, which like is like big in a big like ball, and then in that big ball of X-ray sort of like liquidy gas, you've got all the galaxies inside there, and you can see those with Hubble. And then you've also got a big even bigger ball of dark matter, and what Hubble allows you to do is you can look at the galaxies that are in the galaxy cluster, and you can also look at the galaxies that are behind the galaxy cluster. So if you look at the galaxies behind the galaxy cluster, what's happening is as they emit the light, then as that light passes through the galaxy cluster, because the galaxy cluster is so heavy, the light will be bent.
So it acts like a gravitational lens.
Exactly. So you can imagine you've got a sheet of rubber and you push down on the rubber, that's your galaxy cluster. And then as you roll a ball past that dip in your rubber, sheet of rubber, it will bend around, which is basically what the background galaxies are having done to their light. So what we can do is we can measure the shapes of the background galaxies to infer and try and describe where the dark matter is within the galaxy cluster.
Okay, so let me see if I got this right. So you're looking at the light coming from background galaxies being bent by the galaxy cluster, and from that you can infer how much mass is in that galaxy cluster. You know how much gas is there because of the X-rays. You know how many stars are there because of the visible light. And so everything that's left must be dark matter.
Exactly. That's exactly what we did. It's key to know that the stars are obviously part of the galaxies. I'm explaining this, okay. But we look at the galaxies within the galaxy cluster.
Mm-hmm. The stars are all smoothed out as part of the galaxy.
Exactly. So in the bullet cluster, when you have this collision and the two galaxy clusters pass through each other, what happens is the galaxies will just pass through unimpeded. And they literally don't care about anything. They just carry on, and all their movement is caused by gravity. So they're literally just going through and they don't care. They're just going along on their own way. The gas, as it goes through, will interact with the gas of the other galaxy cluster as these two merge. And what will happen is they'll slow down because they'll get dragged back. So they'll become separated from the galaxies, if you're following me.
Mm-hmm.
And then the question is where does the dark matter lie during these collisions? So the galaxies we know are completely collisionless. They do not do anything. And we know the gas is highly interacting because we know it's hydrogen and we know that it's ionized hydrogen or it's protons. We know it's highly interacting. But as they pass through one another, we know it's all going to, whether it lies somewhere between the gas or the galaxies, will tell us something about what dark matter is doing during these collisions.
And what did you find?
So what we found was that the dark matter actually doesn't slow down at all. So as these huge dense like lumps of dark matter come together, you know, these things weigh 10,000 times the mass of a single galaxy. They come through each other and they do not get affected at all. So they carry on, and within what we've measured, we find they just follow the galaxies completely. They stick to the galaxies like glue. So this is basically showing now that dark matter must not interact to a certain level in these collisions.
So what does that tell you about dark matter? It sticks to the stars, not to the gas. Maybe the stars are sticking to it?
So, exactly. So the galaxies are actually sticking to the dark matter because there's so much more dark matter than there are galaxies. But in the way we, in our model, we account for this. So what it's telling us about dark matter is that dark matter will most probably not be a kind of dark proton-based fluid where dark matter is giving off dark photons and interacting as if two protons see each other. Mm-hmm. It's probably not going to be doing that. So we're ruling out various models of dark matter that try and mirror the universe we have just in the dark sector.
In the paper, you discuss the fact that there are a number of competing models for dark matter, and you're able to rule them out.
Yeah, so I think we've got to be careful when we talk about ruling out exactly. So in the current models they have, various different dark matter models predict that dark matter will self-interact to a certain level. And what we've shown is that they can't, because otherwise we would observe it. But obviously, dark matter models can be tweaked and they can be changed, and theorists can always change the properties. So by doing this study, we're just saying, look, you know, your models at the moment, if you want dark matter to be like a mirror universe, then you cannot have dark matter interacting like protons, and you can't have these dark photons existing and all these things because we would observe it. So now, you know, you can have these models, except you've just got to abide by our observations, if you understand what I'm saying, because like in all of astronomy, in these dark energy and dark matter, you know, you've got theorists that can tweak their models. But with this, we're getting closer to understanding exactly what dark matter is. We see in our world that all the particles, they interact with themselves quite highly, whereas dark matter does not seem to do that. So what we conclude is that dark matter does not interact much at all. It interacts very weakly.
The work CERN's going to be doing, once it starts up, they were going to start up this week, but they've had to delay that. They've found a small grounding. So while they work that out, fix that one up, CERN isn't back online yet at the LHC. Once that starts up, it's going to be looking for the actual particles itself, assuming they find something. Does that tell you much about the properties, or that simply tells you about the physical nature?
That's an interesting question, because what CERN does and all of the ground-based experiments, such as the big, you know, these big vats of like gas where they look for direct detection, what they are looking to do is they're looking to try and see how does dark matter interact and relate to our real, but it's the standard model.
The standard model particle physics, yeah.
Exactly. So how does that relate to the dark matter? So what CERN are trying to do is they're trying to smash the yellow particle to try and create dark matter. So they're looking at a particular property of dark matter. What I was looking at, or I've been looking at, is how does dark matter interact within its own dark sector, within its own dark universe side, which you cannot do from the ground, so they're very complementary in the sense that we are looking at very different things. So you can constrain this property on Earth because you can't get two dark matter particles together and smash them together because we don't have them. So they're both different but complementary.
That's Dr. David Harvey from the École Polytechnique in Lucerne, Switzerland. NASA's confirmed plans to launch a spacecraft to an asteroid in 2020 to grab a boulder off the asteroid's surface and place the rock in orbit around the Moon for future examination by astronauts. The mission's a far cry from original hopes to send astronauts to an asteroid as a prelude for eventual manned missions to Mars. Putting the best light on the situation, NASA says the Asteroid Sample Redirect mission will help hone the capabilities NASA needs to send humans deeper into space, including eventual missions to the Red Planet. Under the new plan, an unmanned spacecraft will fly to a nearby asteroid, deploy a robotic arm to take a boulder from the asteroid's surface, and then make a multi-year journey to put that boulder into orbit around the Moon. The spacecraft will use solar electric ion propulsion systems for the mission. It'll test numerous new trajectory and space navigational techniques, and it will work with the Moon's gravity to place the asteroid boulder in a stable lunar orbit called a distant retrograde orbit. Distant retrograde lunar orbit is considered a suitable staging point for astronauts to rendezvous with the deep space habitat that will one day carry them onto Mars. Before the asteroid boulders moved into lunar orbit, NASA will use the opportunity to test planetary defense techniques to help mitigate potential asteroid impact threats against the Earth. The spacecraft will act as a sort of gravity tractor, using its mass during the rendezvous and orbit phase to affect the asteroid's motion through space. Because all mass exerts and experiences gravity, the gravitational attraction between even masses of moderate size can significantly affect their motion through space. This means that by rendezvousing with an asteroid and then holding a halo orbit in an appropriate direction, the spacecraft should be able to slowly pull the asteroid without touching it, hence the term gravity tractor. The effectiveness of this maneuver will be further increased by the mass of the boulder being collected by the spacecraft from the asteroid's surface. Scientists say it'll take approximately 6 years for the spacecraft to move the boulder into lunar orbit. Once the boulder's in lunar orbit, NASA plans to send two astronauts on its new Orion spacecraft on what should be a 25-day mission to rendezvous with the unmanned vehicle holding the boulder and then study the sample. The crew will be wearing a new generation of spacesuits specifically designed for deep space missions to Mars and beyond. So far, NASA has three near-Earth objects, or NEOs, picked out for the mission, the asteroids Itokawa, Bennu, and 2008 EV5. The American Space Agency expects to identify one or two additional candidates each year leading up to the mission, with a final target asteroid to be announced in 2019. So far, NASA's identified more than 12,000 NEOs, including an estimated 96% of all near-Earth asteroids larger than a kilometer. The agency has not yet detected any objects of this size that pose an impact hazard to Earth over the next 100 years. Of course, smaller asteroids do pass near the Earth all the time, and some of these could also pose an impact threat. In 2011, 893 near-Earth asteroids were found. By 2014, that number had increased to 1,472. Now, speaking of Mars, NASA's Curiosity rover has found nitrogen on the surface of the red planet, a significant discovery that adds to the growing line of evidence that Mars could once have sustained life. The evidence for nitrates, compounds containing nitrogen that can be used by living organisms, was found in rock drill samples collected by Curiosity at the foot of Mount Sharp, a 5.5-kilometer-high peak inside the six-wheeled rover's Gale Crater landing site. Curiosity had previously found evidence for other ingredients needed for life, such as liquid water and organic matter. Jennifer Stern from NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, says finding biochemically accessible nitrogen is more support for the ancient Martian environment at Gale Crater being habitable. Nitrogen is essential for all known forms of life because it's a building block of both DNA and RNA. However, scientists stress there's no evidence suggesting that the fixed nitrogen molecules found by Curiosity were created by life. The research team instead suggests that the nitrates are ancient and likely to have come from meteorite impacts, lightning strikes, and other non-biological processes. On both Earth and Mars, nitrogen is found in the form of nitrogen dioxide, two atoms locked together so tightly they don't interact easily with other molecules. The nitrogen atoms must first be separated or fixed so that they can participate in the chemical reactions needed for life. On Earth, there are some organisms capable of fixing atmospheric nitrogen, and this process is crucial for metabolic activity. However, smaller amounts of nitrogen are also fixed by energetic events like lightning strikes. Back in December, Curiosity detected regular methane emissions near the Martian surface, but the source for that's also still unknown. On Earth, most methane is produced by biological processes. However, there are geologic processes which can also produce the substance. Scientists don't expect Curiosity to find life on Mars. That was never part of its mission. Instead, they've been using Curiosity to analyze soil and rock samples for signs of the key elements of life, which are present and may have supported life in the past. The $2.5 billion Curiosity rover mission aims to study the Martian environment to prepare for possible human missions there in coming years. US President Barack Obama has vowed to send people to Mars by 2030. The House and Senate permitting. The best observation so far of the G2 gas cloud orbiting the supermassive black hole at the centre of our galaxy has confirmed that it made its closest approach to the black hole back in May 2014, and it appears to have survived the encounter intact. The new results using the European Southern Observatory's Very Large Telescope in Chile shows that the object appears not to have been significantly stretched by the black hole's massive gravitational tidal forces, and that it remains very compact. And that indicates that G2 is probably a young star with a massive core that's still accreting material. The supermassive black hole at the centre of the Milky Way galaxy, which has approximately 4.3 million times the mass of the Sun, has not shown any increase in activity. Called Sagittarius A star, the galaxy's central black hole is orbited by a small group of bright stars, as well as the recently discovered cloud of gas and dust called G2. Astronomers have been watching closely as the cloud continues to fall towards the black hole. Closest approach, known as Peribothran, was predicted to be in May 2014. And the great tidal forces in this region of very strong gravity were expected to tear the cloud apart and disperse it along its orbit. Some of this material would have fed the black hole, leading to sudden flaring and other evidence that the monster in the middle of our galaxy was enjoying a meal. To study these greatly anticipated events, the region around the galactic center has been an area of intense observation over the past few years by many astronomical teams using a range of telescopes. The European Southern Observatory team observed the region using the Very Large Telescope over many years, and that's included new observations during the critical period from February to September last year, just before and after the Peribothran event in May 2014. The newly published observations are consistent with earlier ones made using the Keck telescope in Hawaii. Images of infrared light coming from the glowing hydrogen gas cloud show that it was compact both before and after its closest approach as it swung round the black hole. As well as providing very sharp images, the VLT can also split the light from the cloud into its component infrared colours using spectroscopy, which allows the cloud's velocity to be estimated. Before closest approach, the cloud was found to be travelling away from the Earth at about 10 million kilometres per hour. And after swinging around the black hole, it was measured to be approaching the Earth at about 12 million kilometres per hour. Although some earlier observations had suggested that G2 was being stretched, the new observations found no evidence that the cloud had become significantly smeared out, either by becoming visibly extended or by showing a larger spread of velocities. Because the dust cloud is moving relative to the Earth, away from the Earth, before closest approach to the black hole, and towards the Earth afterwards, the Doppler shift changes the observed wavelength of light. These changes in wavelength can be measured and used to measure the spread of velocities of the material, which would be expected if the cloud was being smeared out along its orbit. The European Southern Observatory team have also made a long series of measurements of the polarization of the light coming from the supermassive black hole region, which have revealed that the behavior of the material being accreted onto the black hole is very stable and hasn't yet been disrupted by the arrival of new material from the G2 cloud. The resilience of the G2 cloud to the extreme gravitational tidal effect so close to the black hole strongly suggests that it surrounds a dense object with a massive core, rather than being a free-floating cloud. This is also supported by the lack so far of any evidence that Sagittarius A star is being fed with material, which would lead to it flaring and showing increased activity. Russia has announced plans to build a new orbital space station in partnership with NASA to replace the existing International Space Station when it's retired in 2024. The announcement follows Washington and Moscow recently agreeing to keep operating and financing the existing space station until 2024. Earlier, Russia had threatened to pull out of the orbiting outpost in 2020, taking their modules with them because of growing international tensions over Moscow's annexation of the Crimea and its support for Ukrainian rebels in the country's east. The Russian Federal Space Agency Roscosmos says the new facility, when it's built, will also be open to participation by other nations in the same way as the existing ISS has been. However, in a sign that things in Moscow aren't as rosy as the Kremlin would like the rest of the world to believe, the Russian Deputy Prime Minister Dmitry Rogozin has played down the announcement, saying the Russian government has yet to study the results of the talks between Roscosmos and NASA, and a final decision will be made later. Meanwhile, a Russian Soyuz rocket has blasted off from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in the Central Asian Republic of Kazakhstan, carrying the first crew members intending to spend an entire year aboard the International Space Station.
The second umbilical now separating from the tower, marking less than 15 seconds, the engines igniting. Ramping up.
Engines in flaps up front.
And liftoff. The year in space starts now. Kelly, Kornienko, and Padalka on their way towards the International Space Station.
The thrusters are in the elevated mode. So everything is fine on board. We are still in.
Good first stage performance. The Soyuz delivering about 930,000 pounds of thrust through its four strap-on boosters and single engine. Getting reports. Nominal operation. The first stage measuring 68 feet in length and 24 feet in diameter. Burning liquid fuel for the first 2 minutes and 6 seconds into the flight.
The Soyuz TMA-16M capsule carrying the Expedition 43 crew docked to the orbiting outpost Russian Poisk module 6 hours after launch, the three crew members joining the three already on station. For 51-year-old American astronaut Scott Kelly and 54-year-old Russian cosmonaut Mikhail Kornienko, the year-long mission will double the length of time crew normally spend on station. And for the third member of the Soyuz TMA-16M crew, 56-year-old Russian cosmonaut Gennady Padalka, the mission will see him set a new record for the largest total amount of time anyone has spent in space, a grand total of 878 days over five separate space missions. So far, there are only four people who have spent a full year in space at one time. They're all Soviet-era cosmonauts who lived on the now-defunct Russian Mir space station. However, those missions, which concluded in 1999, didn't have the sophisticated medical equipment that'll be used aboard the International Space Station. Scientists are interested in seeing how the human body fares during long-duration stays in space. It's all part of the ongoing plan to develop multi-year missions to Mars. In addition to more exposure to radiation, astronauts also experience a multitude of changes due to microgravity in space. Their eyesight worsens, they suffer bone and muscle loss, and they experience changes in their cardiovascular and immune systems. Kelly and Kornienko will participate in a battery of experiments before, during, and after their flight to assess both the physiological and psychological changes from being in microgravity for a year. A third participant in the study is Kelly's identical twin brother Mark Kelly, a former US astronaut himself who will serve as a ground-based control subject for genetic and other studies. Japan has successfully launched another spy satellite on an H-2A rocket from the Tanegashima Space Center southwest of Tokyo. The Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency, JAXA, says the new IGS Optical 5 spacecraft will replace an existing optical reconnaissance satellite launched in 2009, which has now reached the end of its working life. Tokyo began a concerted effort to place spy satellites in orbit after North Korea began firing mid-range ballistic missiles over the Japanese mainland and into the Western Pacific in 1998. Japan currently operates five military intelligence satellites, two equipped with optical sensors, and three using various radars. Included in the constellation is a backup radar satellite launched in January. Japan has another three launches slated for this year. The next will be in August when an H-2B rocket carries an HDV cargo ship loaded with supplies to the International Space Station. Then in November, Japan slated to launch an H-2A rocket carrying the new Astro-H new X-ray telescope next. And Tokyo's final launch for the year will also be the nation's first dedicated commercial satellite launch, with an H-2A rocket carrying the Telstar 12V telecommunications satellite into geostationary transfer orbit. And that's the show for now. If you're in the United States and listening to Star Stuff as a radio broadcast, don't forget you can also ensure that you never miss an episode by subscribing to the show as a free weekly podcast through iTunes. Just type ABC Star Stuff into the search box and click subscribe. Or you can download it from the ABC Science website at abc.net.au/science/Star Stuff. We also have the Star Stuff blog, which contains all the space and astronomy news we can't fit in the show, as well as some spectacular spacey images and things on the net I find amusing. Just Google starstuffblog.tumblr.com. That's all one word in lowercase, and that's Tumblr without the E. And don't forget the official ABC Star Stuff Twitter feed for the latest Star Stuff broadcast times, radio stations, and publishing details. Just type in the @ symbol, followed by ABC Star Stuff, all one word and in lowercase, and you'll never miss a thing.